back to Stan.
Okay, so maybe later on. Okay, thanks, Art.
Okay, so maybe, I just learned about Moshe's indisposition this morning, so I didn't prepare anything. So this is very, very much ad hoc. But it's a pleasure to have a chance to say a few things about Louis.
Oh.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay. So anyway, I was a student and then a postdoc for a few years in Louis' group, and Art actually was my official thesis advisor, but I had a lot of interactions with Louis, and both Art's and Richard's talks sort of remind me of some of these experiences. Let me tell you maybe a few anecdotes that I can think of off the top of my head, which maybe shed additional light on Louis, even though I think what Art and Rich said really paints a wonderful and very accurate picture of the kind of a person and the kind of a scientist that Louis was. This is the story that Louis told me. I think it was in the early 50s, and I think it's appropriate because this is the last day and maybe even the last session of the meeting. Louis was at a APS meeting in the early 50s, and I think at the lunch, he had a lunch with some colleagues on the just before the last afternoon of the meeting, and then this young faculty member from University of Michigan joined them for lunch, and he was lamenting that he was giving the last talk of the last session, and therefore he was sure that nobody's going to be still around in the room to listen to it. But this sort of the topic that he mentioned sounded intriguing enough to Louis that Louis decided to go and maybe even delay his flight, I don't remember. And I think with Lynn Stevenson and maybe Frank Crawford. And the talk was by Don Glaser about discovery of the bubble chamber, or the first observation of actually bubbles in a bubble chamber. And I saw actually the one of the first papers that Don published. And, you know, the chamber was basically sort of like a test tube. And the liquid was, I don't know, dimethyl ether or methyl iodide or some god-awful stuff like that. Very, very complex, very, very complicated. And the picture was basically three bubbles in a row. That was it. And right after that talk, Louis got together with his friends and said, we're going back to Berkeley, and we're going to build hydrogen bubble chambers, and we're going to build big 2-meter large hydrogen bubble chambers. And so I should say it wasn't clear whether hydrogen would work. It wasn't clear whether you could build so-called dirty chambers that had interfaces between the metal and so on. And but Louis jumped right in. He saw that hydrogen bubble chamber was an ideal instrument to really look at the kind of particles that you were talking about. I mean, Art showed a beautiful picture of a lambda and K0 that, you know, with the electronic techniques in those days, you could never do that, but you really needed a visual technique and one that covered a large area. You couldn't do it with emulsions because the scale is just too small, and you could never find these kinds of events. So I think it really illustrated Louis' boldness and foresight and the ability to pick the winner, you know, and so on. Certainly it was a golden age of bubble chamber physics for the next 10 or 15 years. So that's one story. Let's see. Now I'm going to almost repeat something, but I remember being chewed out by Louis twice, okay? And both times, again, reflect. One of them was, again, in the snooping business. I think it was at the Bevatron, and I think Louis asked, you know, what are the power supplies for this magnet? I mean, are they generators or are they, solid state? And I didn't know. And Louis said, what do you mean you don't know? I mean, this is your equipment. You should know everything about it. And then he gave me this lecture about snooping, that you shouldn't be worried about, you know, bothering somebody. He says, you're not trying to be president of General Motors. You're trying to be a physicist. And you really have to learn as much as possible. And then I got the same kind of a tour that I think Rich discussed about, going to the old cyclotron building and so on. And I think he mentioned even that I think if my apparatus were just a little bit closer, okay, I would have discovered fission. So, you know, he really tried to analyze, you know, in some sense, what went wrong. And then along those lines, which I think illustrate, oh, so there was one thing that I got chewed out. The second one was, I think it was our maybe second paper on resonances, or maybe even the first one. By that time, I was, I guess, well along in my graduate career that I was trusted with writing the first draft of the paper. And then when I showed it to Louis, when it was finished, and he looked at the references, and he saw that one paper that he was familiar with was not cited. And he got really, really mad. He made me go to the library and go through the last 5 years of physical reviews. And in those days, you couldn't do it on Google because Google didn't exist. So it was really laborious. So, you know, and to make sure that everybody who had any ideas along these lines, because this was rather novel and unexpected, would get credit for it. So I mean, it illustrates again that not towards the people in his group, but also, you know, to the other scientists, he was really very, very sensitive to people getting credit for the kind of a work that he has done. Let's see, what else? The other thing that I remember was an institution that I don't know whether Louis invented it or somebody else, but it was very characteristic of the way things were done in Louis' group. And then the pattern was modeled by a lot of other groups. And there was so-called Monday night seminar at Louis. And what it was a talk, generally about physics, and again, most of the time relevant to the kind of physics that people were thinking about in the group, but sometimes, you know, involved broader and somewhat different topics. And it was in Louis' house, and Louis provided the beer and pretzels, and then there was the talk. And there were two rules as far as the Monday night was concerned. One is that only the speaker and the organizer knew what the topic of the talk would be. So the idea was that everybody was supposed to come. He did not want poor attendance, you know, for a graduate student or something like that, a higher attendance. You know, every once in a while something leaked. And, you know, so did have some fluctuations because of that. But it characterized that. So there was one basic idea. And the second one was that it has to be held on every single Monday night. No excuse. It was responsibility of the speaker to really make sure, I'm sorry, responsibility of the organizer to make sure that there is a speaker every single night. I ran that as an organizer 1 year. And I think I did manage to have 52 speakers that year. Once we had a minor crisis because speaker's wife was threatening to go into labor that evening. And so on. So I consulted with him, and we decided that he still has to go and give a talk. Fortunately, the child came after the talk. So let's see. Oh, yeah, I should mention about pyramids, which I think was not mentioned, and that is which sort of illustrates Louis' thinking as an experimental physicist. Okay, so you don't see something. You have to convince people that you had capability of seeing this if it existed. And that's where this 1 meter or whatever cavern came from. So the idea was that if you look at the picture of a pyramid, it's got a sharp edge. So you look at the cosmic rays at different, coming from a certain direction, but at different locations. So some I just go through the air, and some cut off a little bit of the pyramid, and some more. And therefore, by looking at the slope of this, you could really see how good a resolution that you have and how it agrees, you know, with the location. And then from that, you could prove that you would have seen it, you know, if it were there, and also what would be the smallest size cavern that you could have seen. Pardon? That's right, yeah, okay, I don't remember, but that was basically it. So, yeah, Right. Okay. Anyway, look, I don't remember the details, but I'm just sort of mentioning that because there was definite features that you could interpret in terms of what the pyramid really looked like, and it did was a measure of the resolution, which, after all, is something that all of us experimentalists want to know when we measure something, right? And especially when we're looking for something that is not clear whether it exists or not. So anyway, it was a really very, very exciting time in Louis' group, and it was, you know, great to know Louis and work with him. He certainly was an imposing figure. I had very much sort of the same feeling towards Louis as Rich when I first joined the group, you know. But it's maybe I should stop here, and, you know, I would love to hear comments or anecdotes from other people. Yes, please. Sure, you can work.
Well, I didn't know Louis very well, but I have an anecdote which demonstrates a different aspect of Louis. I'm not sure of the exact year, but it was the year that John Barton was president of the American Physical Society. And it was in the middle of the Vietnamese War. And I was a pretty young guy, but I went to the meeting, the business meeting, along with two somewhat older guys, Mark Ross, who Art Rosenfeld knows rather well, and Marty Pearl, who had been stolen by Stanford from Michigan a year or two earlier. And both of these gentlemen were very strongly opposed to the war in Vietnam, and they invited me to have lunch with them, which I did. I was not very happy about the war, but not quite as enthusiastic, and during lunch, they were planning how they were going to try to get the American Physical Society to have a resolution against the war. And so John Bardeen started the business meeting and talking about the budget and how they were in the hole. And Mark and Marty started bringing up points of order, points of procedure. And John Bardeen, as most of you know, was the only person who ever got two different well-deserved Nobel Prizes in physics, but he wasn't a real good speaker. And after about 5 minutes of this, he was getting more and more flummoxed and walked over to the president-elect, who was Louis Alvarez. And Louis Alvarez, we don't have a podium here, but he walked up to the podium. He stared at Mark and Marty and said, "All right, guys, who has a question?" And they were both quiet as mice.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Bob?
I thought I would tell a little anecdote, which I think I understand better now after hearing these talks than I understood it before. Let me first say, when I came to Berkeley as a graduate student in 67, I was just a little bit behind Rich. I remember an early conversation I had with Willie Chanowski, and Willie said to me, "There's only one genius in Berkeley, and that's Louis Alvarez." And I subsequently became involved in this sort of conflict that Rich alluded to between Louis and Ed McMillan. There were a group of us, Art will remember this quite well, fighting for the opportunity to have lunchtime talks on political issues at the Rad Lab. And it was well known, of course, that Louis was quite conservative politically. But nonetheless, we found that, that Louis had decided he was on our side in this matter. And it looked to many of us as if it was largely because the target of our activities was, in fact, Ed, the director, who had decided we couldn't have these. So we had this rather odd coalition led by my friend Charlie Schwartz and a few others who may be known to those of you familiar with Charlie's activities in the APS. And so among us, we had mostly people like Marty Pearl at Stanford. We had his analogs from Berkeley together with Louis. And The anecdote I wanted to tell actually has to do with the APS, and that's why I mention it. So I was just a lowly graduate student at the time, and this must have been around, I don't know, 69, perhaps 70. And one night I get a phone call from Louis, and I, you know, vaguely knew Louis, not well. I was actually a student of theorist whose career had actually had a lot to do with something that was just discussed. Dave Jackson first, I think, really became well known for his explanation of the muon-catalyzed fusion in 56, I believe it was over Christmas vacation, actually, in 1956. Dave saw, reported this in the New York Times, and sat down and figured out what happened. So I was Dave's student. I didn't work directly with Louis, but I sort of knew him from these political things, and Louis knew what I was up to. And so I get this phone call from Louis, and he says, hi, Bob, this is Louis Alvarez. How would you like to run for APS Council? Well, I didn't have a clue as to what the APS Council was. I probably knew what the APS was. And I'm not sure I was a member. Maybe that was something that was to be taken care of later on. But it became, well, so I don't know, I said, okay. And then after I said that, I began to realize what was going on. And now I understand that it really has to be viewed in the way the speakers mentioned. This was actually a practical joke on Ed McMillan to take this graduate student who was causing him so much grief and get him nominated for the APS Council. And so that's the practical joke that I was a part of, sort of unwittingly, back in the late 60s. I did not win the election. I did not become a member of the APS Council until much later, when I actually inherited a one-year position from George Trilling when he became the president of the APS.
Okay. You know, one maybe thing I forgot to mention, speaking of these Monday night seminars at Louis, that Louis would sit in this armchair right in front, and he would ask the most penetrating, but also the simplest questions. And that was a time he could really get to the heart of the matter, and it really exposed whether the speaker did or did not really understand what he or she was talking about and so on, because it really addressed the questions in very, very fundamental terms. And in some sense, careers were made or broken, you know, right through a talk that you made. So I don't think he was quite as merciless as T.D. Lee that I've seen, but, you know, he was more gentle, but at least he really tried to make sure that he wanted to understand on very fundamental terms what was spoken. And in the process, you could say the speaker's knowledge was exposed. Okay, are there other comments people would like to make? Yeah, go ahead, Art, please.
One of the fun things that was done at Monday night meetings, I remember, was I told you that there was a collection of programs, Pan, Kick, and Examine. So we saw lots of, there weren't PowerPoints in those days, they were slides of various residences, peaks in mass and peaks in missing mass and so on. And there was one case in particular of a visiting Yugoslav by the name of Bogdan Maglish. And Bogdan, who's still around, kept claiming that some of these resonances were split into two close masses and would present histograms showing splits. Well, it was then that Jerry Lynch developed a version of Examine which generated random numbers, but used the Examine format. And so what Jerry loved to do to get people to really try to understand whether these were significant or not was to generate maybe 100 histograms and then show all 100 or thumb through a book of 100 and have the speaker identify which ones were really the events that were being claimed were a peak or a split peak or whatever. And usually it turned out that the author picked the wrong one, and the one which was generated by random numbers gave a more convincing effect than the author's peak. And that was a sort of standard trial by fire for Monday night meetings. No, the Monday night meetings were really very, very important. Stan's right, and we should have mentioned them.
Okay. Thank you, Art. Let's see. Maybe one more comment by somebody? Okay. If not, why don't we thank all the speakers and commenters again. It was a great symposium and a real honor. I mean, good way to honor Louis. I think he would have enjoyed it.